The University of Alabama is now among colleges to see a protest over Israel's war in Gaza. Students gathered at the Student Center Plaza Wednesday to demand the school divest from top defense contractors like Lockheed Martin. However, as WBHM's Kelsey Shelton reports, the pro-Palestinian demonstration was met with opposition.
Students held a large sign that read, "Tide Against Genocide." Led by the UA Leftist Collective, pro-Palestinian demonstrators demanded their school call for an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. The group also wants the school to end its relationship with Lockheed Martin. One of their demands includes renaming Houston Hall, which is named after the former CEO of Lockheed Martin. But the pro-Palestinian demonstration met backlash. Counter-protesters began to congregate on the other side of the plaza. They came with American and Israeli flags. Some students held a Trump banner. Campus police separated the two sides, and you could feel the tension. While the protesters chanted, "Ceasefire now," a counter-protester chanted, "October 7th, referring to the date of the Hamas attack on Israel. But the protesters were unfazed.
With a campus like UA, where it's more notoriously known for its right-wing demographic, it was totally expected.
Noor Al-Din Alapsi is a Palestinian-American. He says he grew up aware of opposition to Palestinians. He says seeing people support them is new for him, and it makes him emotional.
The one thing that changes me or moves me today is that I would have never had expected so many people to speak for us, to stand with us. The magnitude of the movement today is something that we could not have seen a year ago.
Kelsey Shelton, WBHM.
Live from Birmingham, I'm Richard Banks with WBHM News. Police in Birmingham say they've yet to capture or identify who was responsible for a mass shooting in the Five Point South area Saturday night. Four people were killed and 17 others wounded while waiting outside a nightclub. Stephen Basaha of the Gulf States Newsroom says the FBI and a nonprofit organization are offering up to $100,000 for information.
Birmingham police say they still don't know much about the shooting, and they're emphasizing how important it is they get tips from the community, and that anyone who does offer information can remain anonymous. Police do believe this was a targeted killing, possibly for hire. Birmingham Police Chief Scott Thurman said during a press conference Monday that the target or targets had a criminal past that likely led to the shooting.
And unfortunately, being in that lifestyle, you know, that culture and things, unfortunately ended in their demise.
The other people harmed by the shooting are believed to be innocent bystanders. One was standing in line waiting to celebrate his birthday at the nightclub. According to AO.com, the shooting puts Birmingham on track for its highest number of homicides in a single year. For the Gulf States Newsroom, I'm Stephen Basaha.
Two local initiatives are on the ballot today in central Alabama. In Homewood, residents will vote yes or no on whether to adopt a new council-manager form of government. The referendum also calls for a change in the city council, reducing it to four members, plus a mayor who would serve as council president. Currently, Homewood has 11 councilors and a mayor-council form of government. If the referendum passes, the city manager would oversee day-to-day operations in the city. In Tuscaloosa, residents will vote on a proposal that would increase property taxes by an additional $115 for every $100,000 of a home's value. The money will help Tuscaloosa City Schools expand existing programs. And a storm currently brewing in the Western Caribbean could become the strongest hurricane to make landfall in the U.S. so far this season. The storm is expected to develop into Hurricane Helene by tomorrow and rapidly intensify into a Category 3 storm over the warm Gulf of Mexico. Forecasters say it's too early to predict with much certainty where the storm can make landfall, but residents from Fort Myers, Florida to Biloxi, Mississippi should remain on alert. You'll find more news anytime at WBHM.org. It's 6:34 and 76 in Birmingham. It is 70 in Tuscaloosa.
The Birmingham Bulls hockey team play their final home games of the season this weekend. If you go, you'll see players battle it out on the rink and numerous fans taking in the action. But there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. WBHM's Andrew Gelderman spent a recent game day with the Bulls equipment manager to see how he keeps everything from sticks to skates in top shape.
Meet Ray Pack, the head equipment manager for the Birmingham Bulls. It's early on a Friday.
Basically, I've got here at 6:15 this morning, and I won't leave till maybe 10 o'clock Sunday.
That's because the Bulls play two games during a homestand, one Friday and one Saturday. Pack lives about an hour away from the complex, meaning it's just not worth it driving home to sleep between the games.
I'll usually tidy up and take a nap on the medical table till next morning.
Preparing for the game means a lot of laundry and a lot of walking. Pushing a cart of dirty jerseys to the washing machines, pushing a cart of wash jerseys across the arena to the dryers, pushing a cart of supplies to the locker rooms. Pack is always moving, getting his money's worth out of his Hoka tennis shoes.
Right, before the night's over, usually on a game day, I could be between 15,000 and 20,000 steps.
On one of many walks through a back hallway, Pack gestures to dozens of broken hockey sticks littered across the floor. He's in charge of those, too.
Yeah, that's all broken sticks. So we'll have maybe one or two a game sometimes.
Pack says there was one game where 12 sticks broke by the end of the night. He now makes sure there are enough extra hockey sticks for each player to break two and still keep going. Pack walks with purpose. He sets alarms on his phone to stay on top of things. As soon as the practice jerseys were tossed in the wash, boom, the alarm letting him know the dryer was done would go off, sending him across the arena. Once there, another alarm would go off, sending him back to the locker rooms, then back to where he started at the washers.
I just like to stay ahead and, like, while something's going, I'm doing something else. I'm just going to stay ahead of the game. You know, the more you can stay ahead of it, the better off you are.
Pack might get a 10-minute break before the next alarm goes off, sending him running around once again. Players constantly come up to Pack, asking questions. It's clear, if you need help with anything, he has the answers. After hours on his feet, it's finally time for the game.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the ice your Birmingham Bulls!
Even after the game begins, Pack pays attention, standing with his arms crossed, looking out over the ice.
I'm watching the game, and I'm also, you know, my main thing is watching is, if a guy breaks a stick on the ice, I've got to jump over and grab his stick and have it ready for him to come by the bench and grab it. I watch the game, but, you know, I'm watching to see if I need to do something.
This particular game, a referee skates up to the bench and asks Pack to sharpen his skates as soon as the period ends.
Normally I walk off, but I got to wait on the referee to get his place.
He grabs the ref's skates, runs into the back hallways, and makes his way to the skate grinder. Sharpening the skates as quickly as he can, Pack gets them back to the ref before the next period starts. As the Bulls get back to playing, Pack resumes his watch, just in case he's needed. The game ends. That's another win for the Bulls. As fans begin to head home, Pack stays behind.
Once the game's over, then a lot of my work begins again, and that's where I'm doing laundry and get it set back up and reset up the locker room for them again for tomorrow. I'll usually do it at night.
Pack admits it's hard work, but it's always been worth it. He's played hockey since he was 5 years old and has loved the game ever since.
I guess you have to have the passion for it because you don't get paid for the hours you work, but, you know, it's fun and enjoyable.
One thing's for certain, what happens on the ice wouldn't be possible without Ray Pack's work off the ice. Andrew Gelderman, WBHM.
You are also listening to NPR News for the Heart of Alabama, 90.3 WBHM, Birmingham. It's good to have you with us this evening. I'm Lissa LeGrand, and with me in the studio is Kelsey Shelton.
Hello.
Kelsey, we are taking a quick check on the latest results, and we also have some more reporting from out in the field.
Yes, WBHM's Noelle Ananin is at a gathering of Democrats in Birmingham, and she sent this report.
In the main room, there's a huge crowd with a very large screen projected onto the back wall. That's where they're broadcasting live election results as they're coming in. And you can tell if Harris is ahead if people cheer, and you can tell if things are getting a little closer in swing states when there's sort of a dejected silence. As I'm talking to different people, I'm hearing a lot of nervousness from the crowd. One woman said that she's nauseously optimistic, which is a pretty good term for the evening. Most people are feeling pretty anxious about the results so far, but they are holding on to hope. That's another main theme that I'm hearing from people. I got a chance to talk with Terry Sewell and Elizabeth Anderson, who are very much caught up in the whirlwind of media, a little too preoccupied to keep up with the results, but they're very proud of the races that they've run so far and the work that they've done on their campaigns. And so, yeah, there's a pretty large crowd and generally hearing hope and anxiety from them.
That was WBHM's Noelle Ananin reporting. And speaking of Terry Sewell, we have an update on her district. So that race has been called. Terry Sewell is the representative of District 7. She has been the incumbent and she will remain in that role. We are still waiting for races to be called on District 6, District 1, and District 2. Oh, District 1 has just been called. Barry Moore will represent District 1. Barry Moore was formerly the representative of District 2, but when those congressional lines got redrawn, he had to run in the District 1 race. So yeah, Barry Moore, Republican candidate, won that race with 79% of the vote, with 52% of the votes in. Now the District 2 race is, it's shifting on us. Caroline Dobson had been in the lead for the majority of the night. Now we have 36% of the vote in, and Shamari Figures has taken the lead by, I don't even think a full point. He has 50.4% of the vote so far. Caroline Dobson has 49.6%. So these races are really starting to edge out here, Alyssa.
Well, that's true. We'll have to keep an eye on it. And you said 50, how much of the vote is in? 50-something percent?
So in District 2, there is 36% of the vote in. Shamari Figures has 50.4% of that vote.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Yep. My head for math is...
It's 9:38 on Election Day.
Not so great at this hour of the evening. We also can report, this has not been called yet, but Gary Palmer is in far ahead of his opponent, Elizabeth Anderson, at this point. But again, that could change since we still have many votes to count from the state. And you never know. The ballot measure regarding land in Franklin County appears to have been voted in by voters. The yes vote there far outweighed the no vote. What am I missing? Anything else?
I mean, it's just been a very long election day here in Alabama. I think starting with, you know, St. Clair County with that issue, I think it just kind of, you know, in a country where we do have fears about, you know, election interference, you know, a lot of the people that Noel, the WBHM reporter who is out tonight, you know, she's come across a lot of people who are saying, I'm worried about political unrest from this election. So I think we have had a long day here in Alabama and we're going to continue to see the results. You know, they're still coming in. We're still going to see what happens between Caroline Dobson and Shamari Figures. And it just flipped again. So as we're here, Caroline Dobson is now back in the lead with 50.2% of the vote. So it's been a long day here in Alabama. We actually surprisingly have a pretty contentious race on our hands. And we, you know, we'll continue to update you all. Right, Lisa?
That is exactly right. Stay with us. Keep listening to 90.3 WBHM Birmingham as the evening wears on, and you'll hear more news from across the nation and important races in other states from NPR. And again, we'll keep you updated on all things Alabama right here at 90.3 WBHM.
More than half of Alabama's rural hospitals are at risk of closing. That's according to a report released earlier this year. Residents in Pickens County near the Mississippi border know the statistics all too well. Their hospital closed 4 years ago after accruing $5 million in debt. Now the local ambulance service is at risk of shutting down. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen has the story.
Tabitha Pate knows every corner of the Pickens County Medical Center. She worked in the hospital's HR department for years. These days, she stops by the building to check for maintenance issues.
Yeah, the lights up there are out, and I hear the fire alarm going off, too. It's okay.
The hospital used to offer inpatient and outpatient services and a 24-hour emergency department. But since 2020, the facility has sat vacant. Pate says it makes her emotional.
To see the empty halls, to not hear the hustle and bustle of nurses and staff, you know, walking around, it's sad.
Pate says the hospital closing left residents with just a local primary care clinic. But that's only open during weekdays.
Anything past 4:30, you have to go somewhere else.
Don't get sick past
4:30. And all heart attacks happen between 8 and 4:30, you know.
Pickens County, like a growing number of places in Alabama, has no ER, no urgent care, no after-hours clinic. The closest emergency provider is more than 30 miles away. And if you call for an ambulance, it could take a while. Vicki McCrory manages the Pickens County Ambulance Service. She says they have struggled since the hospital closed.
We're doing 36-hour shifts right now just to provide one unit.
And that one unit has to drive further to get to a hospital, so it takes longer to get back to town to respond to other calls. McCrory says the result is people die waiting for help. She remembers one man.
He actually went into cardiac arrest and died before we could even get there. And I mean, he had already waited 45 minutes. You know, that is terrible.
It was a similar story for Grenae Prude. Last year, Prude was driving in town when she started to feel bad. She drove right past the shuttered hospital to meet her family in front of City Hall. They called for an ambulance, but the trucks were miles away and didn't make it in time. Prude's sister, Annie Jackson, was there when her sister passed.
Do I think that she would have made it if the hospital was open? I don't know. I can't say yes or no on that, but she would have had a fine chance.
Jackson says people don't feel safe anymore.
That's how we feel here in Pickens County, that we've been put out on the island and, you know, you're scared to get sick. If you get sick, you got a family member that get hurt. In the back of your mind, you're thinking they're going to die. They're going to die.
Jackson is part of a group of residents and local officials advocating to reopen the medical center. To make that happen, they're trying to get creative. They hope to get funding from state lawmakers to convert the second floor of the old hospital into an adolescent mental health facility. The idea is it would generate funds to support reopening an emergency room on the first floor. Former HR Director Tabitha Pate says it's just not sustainable to try to operate a rural hospital again.
You have a facility that can be utilized, but it has to do something different than rural health care. That's why we had to be forward thinking and look for another option.
For now, residents in Pickens County continue to rely on EMS providers for emergency care. Just this month, local government officials agreed to step in and financially support the ambulance service. The money will help pay for one additional unit that will run 16 hours a day. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
If you grew up in Alabama, you might remember a teacher rolling in a TV cart to watch a movie about Helen Keller. She's an Alabama icon, but not many know her story beyond her disabilities. Touch, an opera commissioned by Opera Birmingham that premieres this evening, aims to fix that. WBHM's Kelsey Shelton reports on why they think the complicated story of Keller and her miracle worker, Anne Sullivan, needs to be told.
During a recent rehearsal of Touch, Helen Keller's brother James stares antagonistically at his mother.
Women can't, women won't, women don't vote. Women can't, women won't, women don't vote. Women don't vote.
In this scene, he's chastising her for allowing Helen to join the suffragettes. James is infuriated by women wanting the right to vote, but he's even more upset by his mother's unwavering support of Helen.
There is a directness of honesty that comes out of James. First it was you, then it was just an annoying younger sister, then it was a younger sister who stole all your attention.
That's the director, Sarah Widser. She wants the cast to get the dynamics of the Keller family just right.
Fine, once again I'm invisible. Older sister, younger sister, whatever it is, she won, I lost.
Touch is about Helen's later life, when romance and career shifts start to hurt her relationship with her interpreter, Anne Sullivan. Michelle Driever, who plays Anne, says viewers will leave with a new understanding of the legend of Helen and Anne.
There is a story beyond water, Helen, water. Helen in particular, we see as a grown woman, you know, with thoughts, feelings, sexual desires, not just this symbol of, you know, deafness and not being sighted.
In Touch, Helen is a three-dimensional character. She's an activist. She's conniving. She has sex. Allie B. Gorey plays Helen and says it gives her chills to play a character with a disability who has an identity outside of it.
I'm an artist with a disability. I have low vision, and I've always been in roles where
having a disability had to be either a secret or something that I had to maybe use as a part of what fuels me, but never comment on it on stage.
Helen doesn't speak in the opera, but she's still given a voice. Her thoughts are represented through a chorus.
Well, we like to think of it kind of like Inside Out, if you've seen that movie.
Catherine Good is Helen's main voice. She says Helen's choir gives the character an agency that would be lost if she were silent.
All we saw was Ali B acting. We would lose so much of her and her humanity and her personhood.
And to lose Helen's sense of humanity would hurt the show, considering she experiences life so differently than able-bodied people. When your sense of touch is the main way you communicate, Gorey says, all of your feelings become heightened.
Like what we think it is to feel the butterflies, when your senses and your sense of touch is the most prickly thing about you.
Touching is essential to this production. Viewers will see touching where they expect to, like when Helen uses Braille. But the director encourages the cast to literally touch each other throughout the show.
Saying this out loud, more physical touch, 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 touch.
She uses touch to keep the symbiotic connection between Helen and Anne always present on stage. Their codependent relationship is what inspired composer Carla Lucero. In fact, she says despite being able-bodied, Anne Sullivan is the one who lacks agency in their relationship.
You know, in the airplane, they say you put the mask on yourself first and then put it on your child. Anne was always putting it on Helen until Anne runs out of oxygen.
She says as Helen outgrows Anne, Anne has to figure out her place in the world.
Almost like a parental relationship, you know, to the point where the parent is like, I can't teach you anymore.
This thinking leads Anne to holding Helen back.
Anne's concerned about where the money's going to come from, or if Helen gets married and, you know, isn't going out on the road anymore, like what happens to her life?
Keith A. Wolfhughes is the general director of Opera Birmingham. He was excited to take on Helen's story, not just because she's an Alabama legend, but because her story lends itself to opera. He wants to emphasize, this is not a documentary.
By combining music, by combining the power of the human voice and all of that, we're able to delve into that deeper human story that I think many people don't know specifically about Helen, but then just highlight that about the human condition in general, that someone with a disability does fall in love. Someone with a disability can change the world.
Opera Birmingham plans on making this and future shows more accessible. The show will be interpreted through American Sign Language. Viewers will have the opportunity to pick up Braille or large print programs. Gorey says,
because we want to make sure that when you're coming to see this, if part of Helen is in part of you, that you get to have that moment of, oh my gosh, I see myself in that.
She says the musical theater space can be unwelcoming to those with disabilities, and she's excited to work with a company driven to change that. Kelsey Shelton, WBHM.
Opera Birmingham is a program sponsor on WBHM, but our news and business departments operate independently. It was a rough spring break for Birmingham Southern College students. That's when the news came the school would be closing. A bill in the state legislature that might have offered a loan to the financially struggling college appears dead for the session. With that in mind, trustees decided to shutter the campus May 31st. Students are experiencing a range of feelings.
It's a bit hard as an international student.
Just heartbroken.
I feel like I'm getting forced out, which is completely out of my control.
I just feel like they could have told us sooner instead of continuing our year based off of, like, hope.
This morning, we hear from three students. What's on their minds as they figure out their futures without BSC?
I'm Sophia Villanueva. I'm a first year, and I'm a student studying architecture. And then I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I got an email during spring break, and then I read in the bold letters, closure for May 31st. I started sobbing for about like 7 hours straight after the news. I was sad, but I also was angry. But like, I understand where they're coming from. They could have given thought to the students, like close off admissions, because I know there was a lot of high schoolers fully committed to coming to BSC. And I know that process for them surely is like really stressful, because now they have to go through applying to colleges all over again. I'm just going to try to transfer. I'm trying to go to Samford or to college in Charlotte. I'm really looking for something like close-knit, like BSC, because I've gotten used to it, and I'm not sure like a big college would really suit me.
Hi, my name is Kennedy Thomas. I am a sophomore currently, and I am a computer science major. I'm also a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated here on BSC's campus. And I actually got the news from one of my sorority sisters in our group chat that we use to like plan events and such. And she said that the school was closing, and not long after that, I got the email. The school did keep us updated, but I felt like it was very limited. Like, there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes that we weren't aware of. So, like, I wasn't exactly sure about, like, what our standing with the school was. There's a lot of, like, arguments and opposing views out there. It's like, oh, we shouldn't use taxpayer money to bail out a private college. But I don't think they fully understand, like, the gravity of the situation and the position that we're being put in by the school closing. One, we're losing like a large piece of history for the city of Birmingham and Alabama as a whole. And it only goes to show how much the state of Alabama cares so little about education. Like, we're quick to open another prison, but to save a institution of higher learning is like where we draw the line. And this issue has been evident in like public schools, but it's starting to like appear more in higher education as well. And I feel like this closure of BSC will be kind of like a warning what will happen if we don't turn it around, basically.
Hi, I'm Jamie Archer. I'm a senior here at Birmingham Southern College, and I'm originally from Huntsville, Alabama, and I'm studying urban environmental science. I'm very thankful that I'm a senior and that I get to graduate. I'm just so sad for, my significant other is a junior. Majority of my friend groups are also juniors, and they kind of are the worst, they have the worst seat in the boat in all of this. When they transfer, they'll probably have to do 2 more years instead of the 1 year here at BSC, which financially is a big decision, because we are a liberal arts school, and so a lot of the people that are here, they won't be able to transfer all of their credits completely. We have some stuff going on this weekend that I think will uplift us. And I think our student advisories and everyone that works at BSC, faculty and staff, are really working their butts off to make campus as normal as possible. Like, I have a test on Wednesday. What? And so it's just kind of like, I think they're trying to keep us in this like normal state of everything's fine.
Those were three Birmingham Southern College students talking about their feelings around the closure of the school. This audio postcard was produced by WBHM's Kelsey Shelton. A special exhibit that wraps up this weekend in Birmingham pays homage to Titusville native Joe Minter. He's a renowned artist, making works with found or discarded items, and it's displayed less as an art exhibit and more as an art environment. WBHM's Kelsey Shelton is our tour guide to Minter's work.
You can't miss Minter's house. African-inspired sculptures and paintings line the dead-end street. He's ambling towards me wearing protective glasses and a hard hat covered in I Voted stickers. Minter starts at what he considers to be his studio, a patch of concrete.
Well, I don't have a studio. Using what I got.
We're surrounded by signage written in his signature font. They say things like, "To the Forgotten" and "God Have Mercy." He's particularly fond of one sign he repurposed. He recently found it at Goodwill.
I'm gonna read it for you. "Never give up," that's my dad is saying. "Believe in yourself."
Minter's art shows a different America, one where atrocities take the forefront and the flag symbolizes oppression rather than freedom. The special exhibit is not at Minter's house, but nearby in a centuries-old steel foundry in Titusville named Mark Steele. Tyler Jones is the exhibit's creative director.
This is a site-specific installation. You kind of get immersed in the world and the story of Joe Minter first before you go into encounter the art.
It's part history museum, part art exhibit. You'll see Minter's art, but you also get to learn about who he is. And the site itself plays a big role in his story. Minter applied to work at Mark Steele in the 80s. He watched his brother get brutally beaten across the street at what is now Memorial Park by Bull Connor's police force. But the warehouse is also an aesthetic match for Minter's work.
The nature of his work being made of steel and the iron and the industrial texture, it really feels like of this place, which made train wheels over a century ago.
Minter creates sculptures using discarded items. Car wheels, bicycle gears, chains, and scrap metal are fundamental elements of his pieces. He uses discarded materials as a stand-in for what he would call discarded people. His art acknowledges the unsung heroes of the civil rights movement.
Acknowledging the people at the margins, and his environment really is documenting 400 years of the Black experience in America.
But Minter is on the margins himself. His most famous work, African Village in America, was never admitted into an art institution. The display lives in an unlikely place, his backyard.
Joe Minter is part of this tradition, which is especially prominent in the Deep South, of these so-called yard shows. He's essentially created this site-specific kind of open-air museum that's in his yard.
Back at Minter's house, he directs me to his back porch. That's where you can get a full view of the African village. I trip over a few paint cans and tools as I make my way there. The site is breathtaking. It's a field of sculptures, but it's also a memorial. Minter calls it an ancestral burial ground.
The soothing love of 100,000 Africans in one spot.
It's serene as we look out at the art. There's bird song and a cool breeze.
That little breeze that just worked out and coming through. That's the ancestor telling me thank you.
A Titusville cemetery sits on the other side of Minter's fence, just beyond the African village. His entire family is buried there. He points out where he will be buried.
That's my grave spot next to the African village. You see how it is set up? That's my wife on that side. And that's me laying this side toward the African village.
Minter considers this backyard installation a home to displaced Black people from centuries ago. He wants this history remembered and hopes future generations keep this story alive. He ends my visit with a few bangs on his drum to honor those who lost their lives during the slave trade.
Thank you, Jesus, and in the name of Jesus, let my people go.
Kelsey Shelton, WBHM.
Create Birmingham, which is presenting the exhibit, is a program sponsor in WBHM, but our news and business departments operate independently. September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and as part of our discussion of the topic at WBHM, we ask writer, musician, and storyteller Sean Dietrich to share a tragic experience from his childhood and how he's found peace in the years after. Here's WBHM's Richard Banks.
Sean is the voice behind Sean of the South. Recently, he wrote about the 30th anniversary of his father's suicide. Sean, would you mind sharing that reflection?
Sure. 30 years ago, it happened. 30 years ago. 30 years ago, my whole life changed, and I thought I'd never be okay again. It was a serene late summer day, and I was a kid, playing outside when the Sheriff's Department cruiser pulled up to our house to deliver the news. I remember my mother collapsing on the floor and sobbing. And I remember personally going into shock when the preacher told me, "Your father took his own life." I remember the feeling that upon this day, 30 years ago, that nothing would be okay, not ever again. And I remember thinking that I would likely not survive my own childhood. As I write this, I sit on a wide lake watching autumn seize the world. The trees of Lake Martin are experiencing the first pangs of fall. There's a slight chill in the air, and a woodpecker nearby is seriously attempting to give himself concussion. But sitting on the lake is a good place to think, namely, because you don't hear much of anything except the ringing in your own ears. You only hear black-billed cuckoos, northern flickers, American kestrels, or a humble American crow. You hear the soprano section of starlings or the flapping of a heron's wings. Right now, I see a few ducks in the far off, swimming. Mallards with brilliant green heads, a male and a female. The female duck is evidently trying to drown the male. They're quacking and clacking for their lives, although it just occurred to me that these ducks are not trying to kill each other. I think they are mating, which is all the same in the end. And I'm wondering what the next 30 years of my life is going to look like, because this life hasn't turned out at all like what I thought it would be. It has been a most wonderful adventure. Life has confused me. It has moved me. It has entertained me. It has hurt me. My own life, like anyone else's, has been an ongoing tale, filled with a cast of characters who are beautiful, sincere, and sometimes bat dookie crazy. And my own character has changed throughout each chapter of life. In fact, I wouldn't even recognize the kid I used to be. I don't even know who I am anymore. In the last 30 years, I have learned things. I have cried a lot, laughed a lot. I have enjoyed certain moments, and I have endured others. And through it all, I have come to believe one thing. I have found a way to sum up the whole of my personal beliefs. I believe there is a driving force behind the universe that keeps it going. It lies in the soil, and it drifts in the air. It's in the water, and in every living thing. It causes flowers to bloom, and mountains to move, and people to grow. And in your darkest days, it is a balm to the heart. And it's love. Just love. That's it. In fact, I can attach no more feeble human words to describe the definition of this profound force except to call it the grace of God. And I have you to thank for that, Daddy. In a way, your suicide was what introduced me to this intense love. I'm currently the same age you were when you chose to exit this world by your own hand. And I can say proudly, perhaps for the first time in my life, that I'm doing okay.
Sean, thanks for sharing that.
You mentioned at least two things in your writing that you say changed your life, your father's suicide and your writing. Talk about how they changed you and what you've learned through those experiences, especially when they intersect.
Well, the two have almost become synonymous, my father's suicide and my writing, because for this stage of my life, my father's suicide exists within my writing. The writing became a, not just a therapy tool, but I would call it more of a surgical tool, in that when someone dies in any way, but it probably, I would say especially with a suicide, in my experience, there's a lot of infection that comes along with it. And that infection, if it's not dealt with, turns into a pus, and that pus begins to build. And if you don't release that, the infection will eat you alive. And so surgically, you go in when you're writing, and you begin to deal with the outside portion of that infection, and you work your way inward. And after a certain amount of time, you will realize that this infection is powerless over you.
In many circles, we don't often talk about suicide. How does your sharing of your experiences play into your public appearances? And do people come to you to discuss the topic before or after?
The interesting thing about it is you don't talk about it because of the social taboos, and that's extremely normal in a civilized America. You don't talk about things that you don't want to exist. And when you're sharing it with someone and you have this brain link, mind connection, they know it's real, you know it's real. You re-experience certain emotions, you experience the good and the bad, and you get deeper into what you're really experiencing and what you did experience. And that is probably the most effective form of therapy that I've ever experienced with another human being. If I had one little PSA to give to anybody dealing with the subject of suicide in their own personal life, it's four letters, T-A-L-K. Just talk about it. Don't bottle it. Find someone to talk to. Talk to yourself if you have to. Talk to the ceiling. But the more you talk, the better it will get. And it seems so simple, but if you try it, you'll find that it's true.
Sean, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Sean Dietrich speaking with WBHM's Richard Banks. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline.